I'm Christopher Lydon with a writer's writer, Lydia Davis, treasured for her tiny gems of stories, some just a page or a paragraph, some just a line, but always honed, precise portraits of a mind on edge. Often they're hilarious, like the best tiny chocolates, they get addictive too. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We're late to the Lydia Davis party, but we're thrilled to get in on it. We began noticing, Miss Davis, that a lot of the writers we love refer to you as their dreamy, ideal, original, contemporary stylist in prose. The Pulitzer poet Ray Armantrout said just about that, but also the novelist Robert Coover and the critics Dan Chasen and David Shields. And for months now, I've been hooked on reading and rereading these 700 pages of your collected stories and rereading them aloud for threads and patterns and clues about how you made them. We're privileged to get to hear them in your voice. Where do we begin?
You probably know them better than I do by now.
I doubt it.
Where would you like me to begin?
I'd love you to begin with a tiny story called Problem.
Okay, yeah, I've got it. This was sort of dating from the time when I was a young parent, and I and a lot of my friends and people I knew were kind of breaking up and recombining, and families were very confusing. So anyway, it's called Problem. It was at one time called Algebra, but now it got the title Problem. X is with Y, but living on money from Z. Y himself supports W, who lives with her child by V. V wants to move to Chicago, but his child lives with W in New York. W cannot move because she is having a relationship with U, whose child also lives in New York, though with its mother, T. T takes money from U, W takes money from Y for herself, and from V for their child, and X takes money from Z. X and Y have no children together. V sees his child rarely, but provides for it. U lives with W's child, but does not provide for it.
End of story.
Yes, and I think as I read it, I realized it also grew out of those logic problems that I really enjoy. You know, so-and-so is so-and-so's sister, but so-and-so is not so-and-so's parent, you know.
Well, I enjoy them too, and I doped this one out. I mean, I diagrammed it and finally figured that there are two grandparents here, two grandfathers, I think, of daughters that have kids. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, you found more than I did. It does work out. It does work out. It's not arbitrary, but I didn't take grandparents into account.
It seems to me it has a relationship to that famous Raymond Carver story, what we talk about when we talk about love. Complications among couples of probably the same period, and yet you reduced it to a postage stamp.
That's right. I think I also love patterns. You know, I love the drama and psychology as it plays out in developed plots, but I also just love the pure pattern that underlies it all.
There's a story of yours that everybody loves called Letter to a Funeral Parlor. Would you read that for the umpteenth time?
I'd be happy to read that. That's it actually started as an actual letter, a serious letter that was intended to be sent, but it changed into such a literary sort of thing that I couldn't send it. But I have to say, later I changed it back again into something that could be sent, and I did send it, but never got an answer.
We'll have to get to the difference between a real letter and a literary quote letter. First, the letter.
Okay. It's called Letter to a Funeral Parlor. Dear Sir, I am writing to you to object to the word cremains, which was used by your representative when he met with my mother and me 2 days after my father's death. We had no objection to your representative personally, who was respectful and friendly and dealt with us in a sensitive way. He did not try to sell us an expensive urn, for instance. What startled and disturbed us was the word cremains. You in the business must have invented this word, and you're used to it. We, the public, do not hear it very often. We don't lose a close friend or a family member very many times in our life, and years pass in between if we are lucky. Even less often do we have to discuss what is to be done with a family member or close friend after their death. We noticed that before the death of my father, you and your representative used the words loved one to refer to him. That was comfortable for us, even if the ways in which we loved him were complicated. Then we were sitting there in our chairs in the living room, trying not to weep in front of your representative, who was opposite us on the sofa. And we were very tired, first from sitting up with my father, and then from worrying about whether he was comfortable as he was dying, and then from worrying about where he might be now that he was dead. And your representative referred to him as the cremains. At first, we did not even know what he meant. Then, when we realized, we were frankly upset. Cremains sounds like something invented as a milk substitute in coffee, like Cremora or Coffee Mate. Or it sounds like some kind of a chipped beef dish. As one who works with words for a living, I must say that any invented word like porta potty or pooper scooper has a cheerful or even jovial ring to it that I don't think you really intended when you invented the word cremains. In fact, my father himself, who was a professor of English and is now being called the cremains, would have pointed out to you the alliteration in porta potty and the rhyme in pooper scooper. Then he would have told you that cremains falls into the same category as brunch and is known as a portmanteau word. There's nothing wrong with inventing words, especially in a business. But a grieving family is not prepared for this one. We are not even used to our loved one being gone. You could very well continue to employ the term ashes. We are used to it from the Bible and are even comforted by it. We would not misunderstand. We would know that these ashes are not like the ashes in a fireplace. Yours sincerely.
May we laugh?
People often can't help laughing. They at first, well, I think they alternate between feeling troubled or worried or sympathetic and then laughing despite themselves, because really, even in the first line, the word cremains is such a grotesque word. And it sits curiously on the fence between familiar and not familiar. And that's why the story can continue to be surprising, because some people know the word, but not all that many are that familiar with it.
But has this letter writer not sort of absorbed the whole problem by the time he or she has finished this letter? In other words, obsessing over ashes and just the words here. For Papa.
So she's sort of processed the whole situation. Maybe, although you never really do, I think. People say you write to get rid of things, you know, but you do in a sense. You've put them in a form that objectifies them a little and puts them at arm's length, but you don't really get rid of them. You have the same emotion that you started with.
There's a very different sort of story called This Condition, not quite X-rated, but almost could be, very dense, almost poetry. I'm dying to hear it.
Right. I'm always fairly discreet, I think, in the end. It used to be because my parents were going to read these stories. I don't know what it is now. So this is called This Condition. In this condition, stirred not only by men but by women, fat and thin, naked and clothed, by teenagers and children in latency, by animals such as horses and dogs, by certain vegetables such as carrots, zucchinis, eggplants, and cucumbers, by fruits such as melons, grapefruits, and kiwis, by certain plant parts such as petals, sepals, stamens, and pistils, by the bare arm of a wooden chair, a round vase holding flowers, a little hot sunlight, a plate of pudding, a person entering a tunnel in the distance, a puddle of water, a hand alighting on a smooth stone, a hand alighting on a bare shoulder, a naked tree limb, by anything curved, bare, and shining as the limb or bole of a tree, by any touch as the touch of a stranger handling money, by anything round and freely hanging as tassels on a curtain, chestnut burrs on a twig in spring, a wet tea bag on its string, by anything glowing as a hot coal, anything soft or slow as a cat rising from a chair, anything smooth and dry as a stone or warm and glistening, anything sliding back and forth, anything sliding in and out with an oiled surface as certain machine parts, anything of a certain shape like the state of Florida, anything pounding, anything stroking, anything bolt upright, anything horizontal and gaping as a certain sea anemone, anything warm, anything wet, anything wet and red, anything turning red as the sun at evening, anything wet and pink, anything long and straight with a blunt end as a pestle, anything coming out of anything else as a snail from its shell, as a snail's horns from its head, anything opening, any stream of water running, any stream spurting, any stream spouting, any cry, any soft cry, any grunt, anything going into anything else as a hand searching in a purse, anything clutching, anything grasping, anything rising, anything tightening or filling as a sail, anything dripping, anything hardening, anything softening.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
I rather like it. As I read it, I thought of Gerard Manley Hopkins, and I don't know if I'd made that connection before. But the way he...
All things dappled and couple-colored, that sort of thing?
Yes, yes. That sort of enumeration of things in nature and their qualities.
And the reader thinks we know where you're heading when you talk about anything going into anything else, and suddenly it's a hand searching in a purse.
That's right, yeah. I think it started with me noticing this sort of rousing quality about certain things, and then realizing how many things had these sensuous qualities of one sort or another, and so in a way you're talking about opposites, hardening or softening, so you're embracing everything in the end almost.
What was the gestation, and how long did it take you to make that list?
I think I usually write very fast, and I was going to say repent at leisure, but I write very fast and then make changes over time. I sort of let it sit. I would think this too would have been it would have come very quickly to me. Once I started, once I got the idea, I would go full speed ahead. I see it in old notebooks that 90% or 95% of the piece will be as it is in final form, but then there'll be a few wrong moves or a little bit extra that I'll take out or change.
Lydia Davis is a very, very different sort of piece that you've written called Glenn Gould, as in the late great Canadian pianist. And the story is complicated. It's about a friend who calls up and reports that Glenn Gould, like the character in the story, loved the Mary Tyler Moore Show. So there's a lot about the show, but it seems to me that what you write about Glenn Gould is it's not only the best short profile of that remarkable mystery I've ever read, and I've read a lot about Glenn Gould, but it's also kind of maybe a confession. I keep wondering, maybe Lydia Davis is Glenn Gould, and maybe his pianism and his understanding of the engineering of his fingers has something to do with your mastery of words and rhythm and punctuation and revision. But I wondered if you'd read from that story the part specifically about Glenn Gould himself, starting where you say that he was a model for you from childhood.
Right. Okay. And of course, Glenn Gould was... The way some teenagers get a crush on, a pop singer. I got a crush on Glenn Gould and would sit there with the record, listening to him and staring at his picture. This pianist was a model for me all the time. I was a child growing up and learning to play the piano. I listened to certain of his records over and over and studied the jacket photographs of his handsome young face and thin shoulders and chest. Once out of my adolescence, I stopped studying his photographs with such attention, but continued to imitate as best I could the clarity of his fingering, his peculiar ornamentation, and his interpretations of Bach in particular. I practiced the piano for as long as 4 hours at a time, sometimes six, beginning with scales and arpeggios and five-finger exercises, then working on one or two pieces, and then playing through whatever I liked from the books I had. I did not intend to make a career of music, but I could happily have spent my days working as hard at the piano as any professional, partly to avoid doing other things that were harder, but partly for the pleasure of it. Now that my initial surprise has passed, I am pleased in several ways by the fact that he liked this show. For one thing, I now feel I have a companion watching the show with me, even though Glenn Gould is no longer alive. During his lifetime, he said several times that he would not play the piano after the age of 50, and 10 days after he turned 50, he died of a stroke. This was a few years ago. For another, the fact that this companion was so intelligent gives me a new respect for the show. Glenn Gould's standards were very high, at least concerning the composition and performance of music, and concerning his own writing. He was also articulate and opinionated, and wrote well about music and other subjects. He wrote about Schoenberg, Stokowski, Menuhin, Boulez, and he also wrote about musicians like Petula Clark. He said that when he was a student, it had dismayed and puzzled him that any sane adult would include Mozart's pieces among the great musical treasures of the West, although he enjoyed playing them. He said he had instinctively disapproved of Alberti basses. He wrote about Toronto, television, and the idea of the North. He said that very few people who went into the North emerged unscathed. Excited by the creative possibilities of the North, they tended to become philosophers of their own work. Rubinstein loved hotels, but Glenn Gould called himself a motel man. He said that twice a year or so, he would go along the north shore of Lake Superior, where there were lumber and mining towns every 50 miles or so. He would stay in a motel and write for a few days. He said these towns had an extraordinary identity because they had grown up around one industry or one plant. He said that if he could arrange it, that would really be the sort of place in which he would like to spend his life. Of course, it is true, as I just gradually discovered over the years, that he had many strange notions and habits. Schoenberg was one of his favorite composers, but Strauss was another. He was known to be a hypochondriac and excessively careful of his hands. He dressed warmly no matter what the season and took his own folding chair with him to concerts, when he still gave concerts, sitting very low in relation to the keyboard. He sometimes practiced with the vacuum cleaner on because that way, he said, he could hear the skeleton of the music. Now Mitch tells me he was fond of a certain rather ugly female pop singer whom he taped, as he also taped this show I like so much. He called the singer's voice a natural wonder and was amazed by what she could do with it. Mitch does not explain what it was he liked about the television show, and I'm still puzzling over this. His sense of humor must have had something to do with it. In his own writings, he is quite funny. I am still trying to understand just how Glenn Gould identified with the orderly woman and the passionate woman, just what sort of companionship he found with these two women and the other characters, if that's what it was. He was something of a recluse by choice. He arranged his life as he wanted it, scheduled his outside appointments as it suited him, watched television when he needed to, and was able to be selfish without hurting anyone. He was a generous and considerate friend, but he didn't meet his friends in person very often because he believed that personal encounters were distracting and unnecessary. He said he could comprehend a person's essence better over the phone. He had long conversations with his friends over the phone, always with a cup of tea in front of him. These conversations usually started at midnight, just before he went to work, since he slept through the day and worked through the night.
Mm. Is that something of a portrait of Lydia Davis in some details?
It's a portrait of her the way she might have wanted to live, if she could have. I mean, I wanted a family, and I definitely was glad I had a family. But it completely changes what you can do and how you can live, of course. And I think that was part of having a family. It keeps you sane in a way. You can't, you know, upend your schedule and stay up all night and be wild and crazy in certain ways. And I think I liked that restraint. But I'm noticing as I read this how that the two parallel things, which I hadn't seen before, of playing the vacuum cleaner while you practice to hear the essence of the music, and then
marvelous,
and then using a phone to talk to your friends to better perceive the essence of your friends. I suddenly saw that parallel. It's sort of imposing limits in order to get to the heart of something.
He was a radio guy. It's all in the sound of the voice. Too bad the phone sound wasn't better. But I'm also thinking, though, of the very, very private, reclusive guy who's also a public performer, a writer, an interpreter, who also refused to talk about technique. He said you wouldn't interview a centipede on how he coordinates those feet, and he didn't want to talk about his fingers. Well, something to that effect.
That's very nice.
Just not to look too deep into the mechanics of the works. But then he was a genius, and he was a modern, as indeed you are.
I sympathize. I don't like to look too deep into the technique, because you're also always afraid you might jinx it or lose it if you get too conscious of it.
Which reminds me, I wanted to ask you about what is the core of the writing project for you in some of these pieces? I mean, is it this psychological sketch of the mind in overdrive, as somebody said? Maybe that was you. Or is it the philosophical substance and the moral puzzles that keep popping up? Or is it the precision of the language in which your people spin the inquiries? Or is it all of them? But I mean, what's the hardest part for you?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer this. You see, I'm floundering around because I'm afraid of being too specific. But I think one thing I can say is that I really don't start with an agenda. I don't ever say I want to write a series of pieces about an ordinary day in the life of a woman, or, you know, or grief, or this or that. I simply start from the thing itself. So whether it's the word cremains or whether it's the cows across the road, whatever catches my interest and maybe causes me to ask a question, you know, why does this bother me or why do I like this? And then I want to explore it in one way or another. With the Glenn Gould, say, you know, it's you start with several problems, like, why do I watch this program? This is not a program about Derrida and constructionism. This is Mary Tyler Moore, and I love it. Now, why do I love it? And so you live with this little problem, and then your friend tells you this wonderful thing about Glenn Gould, who's also a strong emotional presence in your life, and you're so delighted by the connection that you want to sort of expand upon it. So that story comes out of that. So each story, you know, whether it's about a caterpillar or a problem with friends, or there's one I have in which I enumerate boring friends, you know, anything that catches my interest sparks the story. And then when you ask what the hardest part is, some stories really aren't hard. There have been some that took forever to write and went on for 2 years with nothing quite settled. But I guess, well, I'd have to say the endings are hard. And that's true for a lot of people. It's just true for stories. It's hard to end a story well. And some don't end because I really haven't come to the end in my thinking. So I can't just clap an end on them. I have to wait till I resolve the problem in my thinking.
I'm wondering, though, are those epiphanies, for example, there's one where a woman discovers that we treat different kinds of things with different degrees of kindness. You treat a houseplant, and sometimes more kindly than a child, or a child less kindly than a dog. And we have these different relations, and it comes – she's searching for the differences. And I'm thinking, was this written for the epiphany about the way our minds work with things we love, or was it the language, or was it a kind of philosophical probe?
I forgot your part of your previous question about language, because I think the language comes into it all the way through. Usually the story starts in the language it's going to have, and the wording is such an integral part of it that if I don't have the wording right, the story isn't fulfilled or realized. In the case of the old dictionary, I think it was that the epiphany was precisely what's at the heart of the story, that, you know, I think the moment before I might have been very careless with my son, and the moment after I was handling the old dictionary with utmost care.
Mm.
And I realized that I always handled it with the same degree of care and didn't handle my son with the same degree of care.
It's a beautiful piece. Would you just read it?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The old dictionary. I have an old dictionary, about 120 years old, that I need to use for a particular piece of work I'm doing this year. Its pages are brownish in the margins and brittle and very large. I risk tearing them when I turn them. When I open the dictionary, I also risk tearing the spine, which is already split more than halfway up. I have to decide each time I think of consulting it whether it is worth damaging the book further in order to look up a particular word. Since I need to use it for this work, I know I will damage it, if not today, then tomorrow, and that by the time I am done with this work, it will be in poorer condition than it was when I started, if not completely ruined. When I took it off the shelf today, though, I realized that I treat it with a good deal more care than I treat my young son. Each time I handle it, I take the greatest care not to harm it. My primary concern is not to harm it. What struck me today was that even though my son should be more important to me than my old dictionary, I can't say that each time I deal with my son, my primary concern is not to harm him. My primary concern is almost always something else, for instance, to find out what his homework is, or to get supper on the table, or to finish a phone conversation. If he gets harmed in the process, that doesn't seem to matter to me as much as getting the thing done, whatever it is. Why don't I treat my son at least as well as the old dictionary? Maybe it is because the dictionary is so obviously fragile. When a corner of a page snaps off, it is unmistakable. My son does not look fragile, bending over a game or manhandling the dog. Certainly his body is strong and flexible and is not easily harmed by me. I have bruised his body, and then it has healed. Sometimes it is obvious to me when I have hurt his feelings, but it is harder to see how badly they have been hurt, and they seem to mend. It is hard to see if they mend completely or are forever slightly damaged. When the dictionary is hurt, it can't be mended. Maybe I treat the dictionary better because it makes no demands on me and doesn't fight back. Maybe I am kinder to things that don't seem to react to me. But in fact, my houseplants do not seem to react much, and yet I don't treat them very well. The plants make one or two demands. Their demand for light has already been satisfied by where I put them. Their second demand is for water. I water them, but not regularly. Some of them don't grow very well because of that, and some of them die. Most of them are strange-looking rather than nice-looking. Some of them were nice-looking when I bought them, but are strange-looking now, because I haven't taken very good care of them. Most of them are in pots that are the same ugly plastic pots they came in. I don't actually like them very much. Is there any other reason to like a houseplant if it is not nice looking? Am I kinder to something that is nice looking? But I could treat a plant well even if I didn't like its looks. I should be able to treat my son well when he is not looking good, and even when he is not acting very nice. I treat the dog better than the plants, even though he is more active and more demanding. It is simple to give him food and water. I take him for walks, though not often enough. I've also sometimes slapped his nose, though the vet told me never to hit him anywhere near the head, or maybe he said anywhere at all. I am only sure I am not neglecting the dog when he is asleep. Maybe I am kinder to things that are not alive. Or rather, if they are not alive, there is no question of kindness. It does not hurt them if I don't pay attention to them, and that is a great relief. It is such a relief, it is even a pleasure. The only change they show is that they gather dust. The dust won't really hurt them. I can even get someone else to dust them. My son gets dirty, and I can't clean him, and I can't pay someone to clean him. It is hard to keep him clean, and even complicated trying to feed him. He doesn't sleep enough, partly because I try so hard to get him to sleep. The plants need two things, or maybe three. The dog needs five or six things. It is very clear how many things I am giving him and how many I am not, therefore how well I'm taking care of him. My son needs many other things besides what he needs for his physical care, and these things multiply or change constantly. They can change right in the middle of a sentence. Though I often know, I do not always know just what he needs. Even when I know, I am not always able to give it to him. Many times each day I do not give him what he needs. Some of what I do for the old dictionary, though not all, I could do for my son. For instance, I handle it slowly, deliberately, and gently. I consider its age. I treat it with respect. I stop and think before I use it. I know its limitations. I do not encourage it to go farther than it can go, for instance, to lie open, flat on the table. I leave it alone a good deal of the time.
I love that last line. I love so many lines. I guess that works at every level. I mean, both mother talking about her son, realizing maybe she should treat him a little bit more like the old dictionary. I mean, it's good advice, but it's also a great spinning out of a thread of kind of an inquiry that you never heard of before. And it's every sentence of it is gripping to me.
Well, each sentence sort of leads to the next when I'm, you know, I start one place and then each sentence gives me a thought that leads to the next sentence. Really. Well,
which reminds me that I noticed that your prose meets all of David Shields's new demands for great writing in his book, Reality Hunger. The basic idea that we should get a little explosion on every page of writing, lots of aphorisms, lots of angular insights on this strange state of mind that we're in this moment, but out with narrative, out with long arcs of development. The moral seems to be sort of tell me now. Your little stories could remind me often of Emerson's Journal. I mean, or Montaigne. They're just sort of a very wise, interesting person choosing words very, very carefully about something that then becomes wildly interesting.
Yeah, I don't think that all writing, you know, has to be, you know, aphoristic and short and explosive. But I do think the reader should be constantly surprised, but that works in any kind of writing. Because I teach writing too, of course, and the students have all sorts of different approaches and choices of, you know, how they want to write narrative. And so even in the most traditional story, I think the reader should not be able to predict, oh, yes, I know where she's going with that. I know where he's going with that.
Mm. Can I say I'm also just fascinated by the voice in so many of these stories, the narrator who is a sort of bookish New York woman. She's in and out of the city and never has to tell you what city she's talking about. She's a professor. Her father was a professor. She'd been married, brought up a son. She's still absorbed in love with complications, she says. She's fantasizing sometimes about marrying a cowboy so that she could do a lot less thinking. And yet she goes on writing endlessly about her own mental process. Most of the action in her stories are interior. She drinks a bit, but she's not a great housekeeper. She still talks to her husband, and she calls him her husband, though he is married again. She sees a shrink from time to time, but she also follows her own very original, nonstop line of questions and her own answers. I'm getting very attached to this mind. I think I'm learning something. Who knows what?
That's very nice. Well, I think I'm learning something too.
I keep thinking, you know, I make these totally incorrect notes in my margin. Is this the way chicks think? I mean, how many women I know go through these exercises in their heads? Probably all of them.
Well, I was very pleased with my son, who's grown up healthy and a good person.
Why not?
And has forgiven me everything. But he said that a young friend of his, a woman, loves my stories, and one story in particular in which the narrator says that she's really an old man. And why do people see her as this young woman? And he said she identifies with that story, and I'm so tickled by that because, you know, I always think I'm the only one who really feels like an old man inside. You know?
And so now you have to read it.
What she knew. People did not know what she knew, that she was not really a woman, but a man, often a fat man, but more often probably an old man. The fact that she was an old man made it hard for her to be a young woman. It was hard for her to talk to a young man, for instance, though the young man was clearly interested in her. She had to ask herself, why is this young man flirting with this old man?
There are two stories I'd love you to read on the subject of betrayal. That word keeps recurring. Would you read that one where the author is talking about mother and betrayal? It's called A Man from Her Past.
Yes, I'd be happy to. A Man from Her Past. I think mother is flirting with a man from her past who is not father. I say to myself, mother ought not to have improper relations with this man, Franz. Franz is a European. I say she should not see this man improperly while father is away. But I am confusing an old reality with a new reality. Father will not be returning home. He will be staying on at Vernon Hall. As for mother, she is 94 years old. How can there be improper relations with a woman of 94? Yet my confusion must be this. Though her body is old, her capacity for betrayal is still young and fresh.
That's so wonderful. I wondered as I read these stories, Lydia Davis, what does science, and specifically brain science, have to do with the curiosity in this voice? There's one story called Thyroid Diary, in which a woman is trying to monitor the effect of what may be an adrenaline deficiency on her whole vision of life. It's a high time for studying, you know, neurons and synapses, and we're all drawn into this question of the organic brain, which is the context of everything we think and feel. I mean, is this part of your study now?
It's not part of my study, but that fascinated me, the problem of trying to study your thinking with a brain that may not be working properly. And yet, because you don't have a second brain watching how the first one's working, you can't be sure what's happening. And your brain is the only thing you've got to think with. No, I don't actually make deep studies of these things, you know, more than anyone else, you know, reading the odd article now and then.
It reminds me a little bit of Mark Saltzman's novel about a nun who was talking to God and deeply moved by it and having great, great visions. And then she's diagnosed with a brain tumor or epilepsy or something, and she has to make a choice, you know.
Whether to go on having visions.
Sort of Dostoevsky's puzzle. I mean, he was epileptic, and he had terrific highs. He said the highs were worth all the falls and broken bones and disaster of the falls. But this question that we all deal with now, there's so much brain science in the air, like what is our thought, what is our pills or our wiring that's not working today or is working better tomorrow or whatever.
It's amazing to think that it all is physical, at least. I mean, not everyone believes that, but I believe that it all is physical. So everything is there in the brain. And that's an amazing, I mean, that what is true spirituality sort of grows out of this very physical, or has a place in this very physical mass of matter, tissue.
You speak about teaching, but I also wonder where you learned what you know, what you consider to be your shaping influences, or the writers that inspired you. I mean, I hear different writers in the background, but I wonder what you hear.
Well, I may not even be right. You know, it's all a theory. But I know I studied Beckett and Kafka very closely.
I keep hearing Beckett.
Yes. And when I started writing the very shortest pieces, I had been studying Kafka's Parables and Paradoxes very, very closely. And I was even imitating him to some extent, which I don't think is harmful in the very beginning. I was immersed in language and language study from birth, practically, because both my parents were writers and critics. And they would comment not just on our grammar, which was already very good, so, you know, they didn't have to, but on our phrasing and our, you know, did we have a careless repetition in there, you know? And I'm talking about not our writing, but just our conversation. So we got very conscious, my brother and I, particularly about how we talked, conscious of how we talked. And but then I had very good training in school, but I've realized gradually how well-read my friends were. So there was a whole community, even in high school, of very well-read. For example, the poet Bob Perlman was a good friend in high school. So I was very privy to the sort of philosophical questions that were going on in the minds of my young fellow writers. So it was an intensive, like unending intensive, writing intensive sort of thing.
Flannery O'Connor?
She was, she's definitely a writer I love now. Whether I don't think, I wouldn't name her as a deep influence. I read very few even modern writers after Beckett and Joyce. I read Grace Paley after a while and really learned from her, her economy and her, she's got everything, the economy and the wit and the very deep seriousness. I admired her tremendously.
Alice Munro?
Alice Munro, I liked very much her her stories about her youth and the Fox Farm, and less so some of the stories about cocktail parties and a different world that I thought she didn't write as well about.
You know, Paul Harding, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Tinkers, which I love, he was formed in many ways by Elvin Jones, Coltrane's drummer, and he talks brilliantly about it. I think in certain ways I hear not only Glenn Gould in your work, but Johann Sebastian Bach in the perfect architecture and rhythm and counterpoint and precision, the rhythmic precision of your words. Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I still find him so much more satisfying than many others. But I was realizing, too, that music classes, even in high school, there was a very good and serious music teacher, and we would have music theory and be asked to you know, write chord progressions and this and that, or listen to music and hear bridge passages. And, you know, we were being taught the structure of a piece of music. And I think, you know, at the time I thought, all right, I'm learning music theory and structure. But I didn't think it would go on to apply to life in general. But I think once you study structure so intensively in one field, you become good at studying structure in other fields.
Mm. You refer to these early stories. Could I just ask, what was the outline of your public career, so to speak. And how did the market respond to your early work?
I started with small press books published really by friends. So there was an enthusiastic, very small audience for what I was doing. You know, very enthusiastic, but very small. And so these were small press books that sort of looked like poetry books and were shelved with poetry. And there were always people who liked very much what I did, but it takes some people, you know, and I'm not sorry about this, it takes some people a while to get to like what I'm doing. Some people are very indignant at you know, someone writing a story that's only a line or two and calling it a story and asking, putting it in a book and asking someone to read it. And they feel cheated, you know, if they buy a book of stories, and they're not all full-length stories. There's some of them are very short. But then there are others, you know, of course, who are delighted by that. And you really can't please everybody. So, and, you know, I wouldn't even dream of trying. I please myself, and then whoever wants to join me can join me, you know.
Lydia Davis, would you read from some of the work under your hand these days?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I have two things I could read. One is some sections from a piece about the cows across the road, which is really just observations of the cows. And the other, I brought two stories from Flaubert. So whichever you'd like for me to start with, or
let's start with cows and work up to Flaubert.
Okay. I'll just read a few minutes worth. These observations were written over a couple of years. We had moved to the country, and I had wished there were cows in the field across the road, but there were none. And when we'd been there 6 months, the neighbors obligingly bought three heifers, and I began watching them, little knowing that I would watch them so much of the time. So I look out the window every now and then and see something that interests me about them and write it down. But I'll just read a page or two. The cows. Each new day when they come out from the far side of the barn, it is like the next act or the start of an entirely new play. They amble out from the far side of the barn with their rhythmic, graceful walk, and it is an occasion like the start of a parade. Sometimes the second and third come out in stately procession while the first has stopped and stands still, staring. They come out from behind the barn as though something is going to happen, and then nothing happens. Or we pull back the curtain in the morning and they are already there in the early sun. They are a deep, inky black. It is a black that swallows light. Their bodies are entirely black, but they have white on their faces. On the faces of two of them, there are large patches of white like a mask. On the face of the third, there is only a small patch on the forehead the size of a silver dollar. They are motionless until they move again, one foot and then another, four hind, and stop in another place, motionless again. So often they are standing completely still, yet when I look up again a few minutes later, they are in another place, again standing completely still. When they all three stand bunched together in a far corner of the field by the woods, they form one dark, irregular mass with 12 legs. Because there are three, one of them can watch what the other two are doing together. Or because there are three, two can worry about the third, for instance, the one lying down. They worry about her even though she often lies down. Even though they all often lie down. Now the two worried ones stand at angles to the other with their noses down against her until at last she gets up. One thinks there is a reason to walk briskly to the far corner of the field, but the other thinks there is no reason and stands still where she is. At first she stands still where she is while the other walks away briskly, but then she changes her mind and follows. She follows, but stops halfway there, Is it that she has forgotten why she was going there, or that she has lost interest? She and the other are standing in parallel positions. She is looking straight ahead. How often they stand still and slowly look around, as though they had never been here before. But now, in an access of emotion, she trots a few feet. I think I can stop there.
Well, it is, like everything else you do, it is addictive. There again, though, I was thinking, if Beckett had been a woman, and not hawkish and handsome, but perhaps prim and very feminine and smart as a whip, I mean, he might have written some of those observations on cows, the mind reading of cows.
Yes, well, it's all from the outside. I do a little mind reading. I try to do a little mind reading, but I have great respect for them. I don't presume to know, but I can guess.
Mm. A lot of people know that you translated Madame Bovary by Flaubert in an important new rendition. Where does he lead you as a story writer?
I think one thing I appreciate about him is this very sharp detail. He sees everything. He doesn't miss anything in a description, in the portrayal of someone's character as revealed by the smallest thing, and how they wear their clothes or how they stand. I'm very taken by that. His economy, he would cut and cut. While I was doing the translation, I looked at his rough drafts, which you can do online, and just terribly impressed by how much he would write before he cut it all back to just the essentials. And he's able to make time go by, years go by in a paragraph without your feeling that you've lost anything. So what I did when I made these Flaubert stories was, as I was working on the translation, I was reading his letters, both to get to know him better and to get to know his writing style better, because, of course, he didn't revise the letters extensively, because you just couldn't in those days. You wrote them and that was it. You might cross out one or two things. So I wanted to see what his natural style was, and also what he was feeling about the book, the novel, as he wrote it. But in the course of reading these letters, I found him telling very nice little stories to his correspondent, who was Louise Collet, his mistress and friend, and who was a poet herself. So I was so taken by these stories that I eventually collected 10 of them and reshaped them into full stories. By that I don't mean I added substantially, but just that I shaped them enough so that they no longer seemed like just an anecdote in a letter, but a story, complete story. So I could read a couple of those if you like. Yeah, the first one, usually I didn't fiddle too much. The first one actually combines two material from two different letters. But that was the fun of it, was to translate him, but also, and to keep it in his language and keep his material, but also to have the freedom to shape it. It's called After You Left. You wanted me to tell you everything I did after we left each other. Well, I was very sad. It had been so lovely. When I saw your back disappear into the train compartment, I went up on the bridge to watch your train pass under me. That was all I saw. You were inside it. I looked after it as long as I could, and I listened to it. In the other direction, toward Rouen, the sky was red and striped with broad bands of purple. The sky would be long dark by the time I reached Rouen and you reached Paris. I lit another cigar. For a while I paced back and forth. Then, because I felt so numb and tired, I went into a cafe across the street and drank a glass of Kirsch. My train came into the station, heading in the opposite direction from yours. In the compartment I met a man I knew from my school days. We talked for a long time, almost all the way back to Rouen. When I arrived, Louis was there to meet me as we had planned, but my mother hadn't sent the carriage to take us home. We waited for a while, and then by moonlight we walked across the bridge and through the port. In that part of town, there are two places where we could hire a hackney cab. At the second place, the people live in an old church. It was dark. We knocked and woke the woman who came to the door in her nightcap. Imagine the scene in the middle of the night with the interior of that old church behind her, her jaws gaping in a yawn, a candle burning, the lace shawl she wore hanging down below her hips. The horse had to be harnessed, of course. The breeching band had broken, and we waited while they mended it with a piece of rope. On the way home, I told Louis about my old school friend, who is his old school friend, too. I told him how you and I had spent our time together. Out the window, the moon was shining on the river. I remembered another journey home late at night by moonlight. I described it to Louis. There was deep snow on the ground. I was in a sleigh wearing my red wool hat and wrapped in my fur cloak. I had lost my boots that day on my way to see an exhibition of savages from Africa. All the windows were open and I was smoking my pipe. The river was dark. The trees were dark. The moon shone on the fields of snow. They looked as smooth as satin. The snow-covered houses looked like little white bears curled up asleep. I imagined that I was in the Russian steppe. I thought I could hear reindeer snorting in the mist. I thought I could see a pack of wolves leaping up at the back of the sleigh. The eyes of the wolves were shining like coals on both sides of the road. When at last we reached home, it was 1 a.m. I wanted to organize my work table before I went to bed. Out my study window, the moon was still shining, on the water, on the towpath, and close to the house on the tulip tree by my window. When I was done, Louis went off to his room, and I went off to mine. Mm. I combined, he talked about the sleigh ride was in another letter, and so I slipped it into this one.
The moon on the towpath, I mean, the red wool hat, you're right, all those unforgettable little snapshots.
Yes. And they're all his, of course.
Mm.
I think what captivated me so much was the image of the dark church with the woman inside in her nightcap and the candle. That. So would you like one more shorter,
please.
Or this is quite a bit shorter.
Sure.
This is called Pouchet's Wife. Tomorrow I will be going into Rouen for a funeral. Madame Pouchet, the wife of a doctor, died the day before yesterday in the street. She was on horseback riding with her husband. She had a stroke, and she fell from the horse. I've been told I don't have much compassion for other people, but in this case I am very sad. Pouchet was a good man, although completely deaf and by nature not very cheerful. He doesn't see patients but works in zoology. His wife was a pretty Englishwoman with a pleasant manner. She helped him a good deal in his work. She made drawings for him and read his proofs. They went on trips together. She was a real companion. He loved his wife very much and will be devastated by loneliness. Louis lives across the street from them. He happened to see the carriage that brought her home and her son lifting her out. There was a handkerchief over her face. Just as she was being carried like that into the house, feet first, an errand boy ran up. He was delivering a large bouquet of flowers she had ordered that morning. Mm. Oh, Shakespeare. I love the ending.
Oh.
And that, of course, that's his ending, not mine. Oh, Shakespeare.
Lydia Davis, this is such a treat. We are hearing everything James Wood wrote about you in The New Yorker. The combination of lucidity, aphoristic brevity, formal originality, sly comedy, all of those things from one of the quiet giants of American fiction. It's just a huge treat. May I also say this book, The Collected Stories of Lydia Davis, with its sort of pinky orange cover, sits beautifully in the hand, full of white space as a kind of reader's breather. But it's just been a joy to read, and it's a joy to hear you read from it.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Ours entirely. Thank you so much. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.